C2PR. Number 24B.
All right. So, this is an interesting passage here. Huh? It says, go out from the beauty and bounty and rejoice in it. So, within ourselves, we should really sit back, you know, in the evening or whenever we want, and where we say, what is being all about? What is that whole being about? What I'm doing here on this earth? What is this earth? What is this life here? What is really reality? What is really happening? And if I want to go into the depths of it, I begin to realize, well, I go out from the synonymous terms. That's the only standpoint. I go to the Father. I let the Father tell me what he's telling me. He knows what he wants to tell me. And I listen to that melody and go along that creative melody where I see that all that there is going on and ever is going on is that one mind as the only mind as spirit, as soul, as that unchangeable mind that never changes. Therefore, that stays what it is and remains what it is. I never have to fear that it will change, become different, so I can rely on it. I see that that mind is principle, that that only mind always interprets itself, that that mind becomes the interpreter of everything, that through only that mind I know what is going on. And that mind only knows what's going on, namely his own realm of ideas. Never knows anything about the material universe, the erroneous universe. I just can't make God Almighty know sin, sickness and death. I just can't make him do that. So I better give in and rejoice with him that he doesn't know it. And so I fill my thought with that and see that that mind is really life. Known to God, known to mind, but that mind knows itself as life, as the only existence in being, that there cannot exist another mind. There cannot exist a human mind, a mortal mind, a political mind, a military mind, an economical mind, and an evil mind, and an irritated mind, and a psychological mind, and all these minds, they just can't exist. If mind is life, if mind is the only existence there is, so there is only one mind existing, and I stay there. You know, it's very beautiful to stay there and look at that, huh? Just to see how the whole world falls to pieces, that all those minds there that think they have a very important mind and that can really run the universe, and they can run the business, and they can run science, and they can run theology, and I don't know what, but they just can't. Ah, it's beautiful, a beautiful scenery. You watch it. It's much nicer than usually as a TV show. And you watch how that whole world falls to pieces, because mind is life. Mind is the only existing mind. Or you go and see, it's only known to God, to mind, and that mind knows what? Knows truth. Does not know error. And so you go along that term, that line, and you see that mind knows only the truth, knows only always the true form of everything, the true gestalt of everything, the true consciousness of everything. And so it begins to see that there is no hidden consciousness at work, there is no archetypal consciousness at work, no collective subconsciousness at work, there is only one consciousness at work, and that's the divine consciousness. And so you come to that mind that is love. Say, mind knows itself only as love. So I see that wonderful sense, that mind, as that intelligence, which is the only intelligence, is always fulfilling a plan of mind. It's not just zigzagging around in the universe, but has a very definite purpose and says, this is what I want to achieve. I have a telefinalistic view. I want that the whole world gets saved, comes to the point of spirit. that love is spirit, that the only reality that will be acknowledged will be spirit. And so love works on that issue and works in order to destroy a material sense of things, and is forcible to do it, and uses every kind of means and ways and channels to do it, because love wants us to get out of this whole false concept of the universe. Yeah. Where is that realm? I think we always feel we are living in a universe, and that universe is a universe where there is a sun, and around the sun some planets. The Earth, the moon is running around that sun, and that sun is somewhere a tiny little thing in the Milky Way, you see, just nothing there, and that Milky Way is just one of some billions other galaxies and so on, just nothing. And then I think, my word, that whole concept is wrong. That whole concept of a universe that is big, big, and becomes every day bigger, the more the astronomers look into the universe, becomes bigger and bigger, but it always becomes material quantitatively bigger. It's just the same old material limited concept. So that one begins to feel, you know, that there is a being, that there is a universe that has nothing at all in common with this stellar universe, with this universe of galaxies, that it is of a completely different nature. You know, sometimes I think it is like a radio, listening to a radio station. And it comes through very clear, and it comes through very clear, and you listen to it, and listen to it, you think, this is really so. That's one universe. Forgetting that you could turn the knob to another station, which presents you a completely different picture, another world. I think we should have that sense where we see we are trained since thousands and thousands of years into thinking that this universe which we conceive with stars and galaxies and so on, with black holes and so on, that is the universe in which we live. But we are not. We are not. We have an absolutely different universe that has no comparison with the present material universe. So that material universe must not be improved. It is to be let go. We have to let it go. Or where do you think after some other 100 years you will be? In a universe where you still look up to the moon and to the sun? I can't figure out that. But after we hopped over, that will be in a universe, again with the sun and with the moon and with the Earth and with a stellar universe. It's another universe, so why not have it now? If it's anyway another one, it must exist. And if it exists, it must exist right here and now. And it's just a question that we are so blinded and so limited in our outlook that we take this universe as granted, as given, as a given factor. And now we have to work on that. So we are going to work on that factor. To do what? Just to find out that it gets bigger and bigger. That's all. Whereas, I think the time comes, I think this is up on us, that material history is drawing to a close. Why not take it? Well, it isn't terrifying, on the contrary. It is not at all terrifying. On the contrary, it's thinking, my word, then I lose all those limitations and all those people. I lose the whole people universe. Wouldn't that be wonderful? I have no more people universe, no more a matter universe, no more a limited universe, but a universe that is right here and now, which is on a completely different wavelength than what I'm listening in at the moment. I listen on a wavelength that says there is a material universe and we better have to take care of that universe, and it blows up and it blows up and it blows up with us, and then we are blown up. So what then? To see, now Mrs. Eddy wants us to lead into a universe that is here and now, but on a different wavelength. If I may put it that way, I guess you understand what I mean. Which is on a different system of reference. We changed a system of reference from a humanly material limited system of reference to a divinely spiritual unlimited system of reference. That we'll do. And that is what she says, well, Christian should rejoice in a secret beauty and bounty. Hidden from the world. The world does not know that new universe. We should know it. Therefore, we should not so much run after the old universe, which is anyway no good. But a universe that is known to God. So in that prayer of love, of the beauty and bounty, I like always to think, what is God's universe? How does God's universe look like? I don't know what it looks like properly, but I have a first inkling of it, because if God is mind and spirit and soul, the principle of life, truth and love, I know something about that universe. And that's the only universe that is worthwhile. So, we go to the next. And we come to love as spirit. And this tone gives us also something to think about in the way of text interpretation. She says, a great sacrifice of material things must precede this advanced spiritual understanding. Now, she always comes with spiritual understanding, because that was a keynote in the introductory paragraphs, is that she said, well, the prayer that heals the sick and reforms the sinner is a spiritual understanding of him, a non-self-love. So everything gears towards spiritual understanding. And here she says, a great sacrifice of material things must precede that. And if one looks at the chapter on prayer, one feels, but she has actually not spoken very much about a great material sacrifice. She has said here and there that in order to follow Jesus, in order to follow Christ, you have to drink the cup and so on. But in order to arrive really to this advanced, it's an advanced spiritual understanding, she says there must be a great sacrifice of material things. And actually, when one asks, what is that? A great sacrifice, not only to sacrifice, then I think this is Atonement and Eucharist. That she would say, you actually only reach the advanced understanding of prayer if before you have gone through Atonement and Eucharist. Which is something that we will always see. You see, we have a textbook that has 16 chapters. We can see that there is the way of life in it, namely that we start with prayer, go on then with Atonement and Eucharist, then come to marriage, then to Christian Science versus Spiritism, and so on until we arrive at Apocalypse as a climax. But we know that in being there is no such a thing as a straight line with a beginning and an ending. Being is always a line that is a circle. The beginning always goes on and comes to an end, and the end always forms the beginning on a spiral way. Therefore, actually, only as one goes further with the chapter, say with the second chapter, we begin to understand the deeper meaning of the first chapter. We cannot study the first chapter for 10 years and then say, now I know that first chapter, I have done that, I spent my next 10 years on the second chapter. But it says, if you have caught the tone of the first chapter, you go to the second chapter, and when you have seen something of the main tone of the second chapter, that improves your knowledge of the first chapter. You get the better insight into the first chapter. And if we go on to the third chapter, that third chapter then says, if you catch the tone there, then that really helps to understand again the prayer chapter and the Atonement and Eucharist chapter. And then you come to the fourth chapter even more so. When you understand that, that gives a real new light on the first chapter, so that each chapter feeds into the preceding chapter. And in that way, we never get really to an end in understanding the textbook. So we never will be able to say, I have done this chapter. You know, just as when we were studying the synonymous terms, we never really could say, I have done mind. Now I go to spirit. So I never have to go back to mind. I have done that now. I know that now. We can never really get the tone, the real tone of mind, before we don't have studied spirit and soul and principle, life, truth and love. Because that's the synonymy principle, which says one synonymous term is only seen in its fullness when it is seen also within the other synonymous terms. That's what differentiates Christian science from another science. There we can study, so to say, one aspect. We can study a mechanical law, whatever that mechanical law may be, the law of the lever. Do you say the law of the lever? Yes? Well, if you know that law of the lever, you know it. Nothing can improve that anymore. And that law happens here on Earth, and that is the same law as on the moon. The law of the lever is the law of the lever, finished. And then you can study other laws in mechanics and in physics. They are, so to say, self-contained. Not so in the science of being. No synonymous term is self-contained, so that it is absolutely something that is in a watertight compartment, John Dolly used to say, and then next there is another watertight compartment, another drawer where you can take out and nicely put away and store away spirit or soul. We only know mind when we know mind as spirit, as soul, as principle, life, truth and love. So, with the chapter 2, we only really get the depth of the chapter on prayer when we have touched also the other chapters. And here I feel, right from the beginning, I always felt, well, she says, a great sacrifice of material things must precede this advanced spiritual understanding that I said, but prayer didn't really explain to me the great sacrifice of material things. It only indicated that that is necessary. But the actual sacrifice we have not gone through. But that is what the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, will really tell us. It's all about that sacrifice. It's all about the laying down of the mortal. It's all about showing that if we have those seven tones, those seven prayers, that they give us that strength and that power to lay down the opposite, so that we do not have to draw the power to handle error from within us, from the human, huh? From a material will, from a material action, but that there are those seven prayers within us, those seven spiritual attitudes within us, which have by itself, out of itself, the strength to lay down the opposite. So in Tomen and Eucharist, you always will find the positive overcoming the negative. That the Christ will have to overcome evil at every point. You see? So, I think she wants to indicate we really only get the true spiritual understanding of that prayer if we have gone through Atonement and Eucharist. Because if we have not gone through Atonement and Eucharist, the evil atmosphere, the evil suggestions, the wrong attitude is still lingering around in our consciousness and has not been resolved really, because prayer only says go further, elevate your thought, you go from one stage to the next and you fill your consciousness with the goody goodies, huh? But these must also be able to overcome, to wipe out, to annihilate the very opposites that are within us. And that's why atonement is a Eucharist. That becoming one with the true ideas is also a Eucharist, where you have to drink the cup. You have to swallow, really, all those false suggestions that want to stand in our way. That's why she said the advanced spiritual understanding, the highest prayer, is not one of faith merely. It's not one of faith merely. She used faith constantly, as you have seen. It is demonstration. It is demonstration. The demonstration of our faith we get in Atonement and Eucharist, not in prayer. Because Atonement and Eucharist says, now take what you have got in prayer and overcome with that all that is the opposite, the counterfeit within you. So the actual demonstration of prayer is Atonement and Eucharist. So such prayer heals the sick. It is as if she said, now I prepare thought for what is coming, and must destroy sin and death. It distinguishes, Spirit distinguishes now between truth that is sinless and the falsity of sinful sense. So we have here that very definite sense of spirit that says, before we have not really made a line of demarcation between those material things which we have to sacrifice and the spiritual facts, the spiritual understanding, the understanding of spirit, and have not distinguished between truth and that is sinless and the falsity of sinful sense, if we have not made that, we cannot go further. Okay, and we take our master taught his disciples. Here we have it, what we are talking about. One brief prayer. He didn't teach many prayers, which we name after him the Lord's Prayer. Which, before I said, the Lord's Prayer is the prayer of spiritual sense, prayer of soul. Our master said, after this manner, therefore, pray ye. He gave the rule. He laid down the rule for prayer and said, this is the way you should pray. It's one prayer. And then he gave that prayer which covers all human needs. You get the tone of love. Love as soul. That which covers all human needs is the prayer of soul, the prayer of spiritual understanding. There is indeed one doubt among Bible scholars whether the last line is not an addition to the prayer by a later copyist, but this does not affect the meaning of the prayer itself. That's just a side note. We don't need to interpret that. She makes a side note, an intelligent side note, and say, you know, the most Bible scholars feel that the eighth statement in that Lord's Prayer is not an original, is put in by a later copyist, and I think today practically all the Bible scholars agree with that, that the last statement is not from the original. So that it's interesting, you see, because that shows that actually the original prayer is a sevenfold prayer, not an eightfold prayer. Thank God, somehow the scholars have found that out too. They've seen this is not really, this is like an orthodox, what you call it? Doxology, yeah. Like a doxology that has been put in perhaps by some monks or so because it fitted in with their chorals and so on, with their singing and so on. But that really the instruction in it, they could see, is not the original. So this does not mean very much. The main thing is that we have seen that the prayer of love that covers all human needs is the prayer, the Lord's Prayer, the prayer of spiritual sense. See, where we rely on the spiritual sense. Yes, I think I stop here, or we miss the beautiful things if I try to hurry too much. So tomorrow we will finish this and the Lord's Prayer. We have 2 hours tomorrow, so we have more than what we need. And so we'll just talk around the bush a little bit tomorrow.